You are now listening to CJSF 90.1 FM, broadcasting from Burnaby, BC.
Hi, I'm Andre Goulet. You're listening to Harbinger Showcase. Harbinger Showcase is a weekly podcast syndicated to community and campus radio, including CITR, CJSR, and Co-op Radio in Vancouver, Victoria's CFUV, CIVL in Abbotsford, CKUW and CJUM in Winnipeg, at Met Radio in Toronto, at Radio Laurier in Waterloo, at CFMU in Hamilton, at CJM in Windsor, at Montreal CKUT, and at CJBU in Sydney, Nova Scotia. I'm featuring highlights from the country's favorite progressive podcast community. Since launching in 2020, the Harbinger Media Network's become Canada's number one listener-supported nonprofit podcast network, featuring 83 shows exploring politics, society, and culture from progressive perspective. Find out more about the community and subscribe to our weekly newsletter at harbingermedianetwork.com. On this episode, a special conversation with John Sampson Fellows and Emily Leadham from the John Howard Society, Manitoba.
Gone missing like teeth. The sidewalks are watching me think about you. Sparkled with broken glass. I'm back with scars to show. Back with the streets I know. Will never take me anywhere but here.
Listen to Harbinger Showcase on your campus and community radio station. I'm in Winnipeg, Manitoba, with Emily Leadham and John Sampson Fellows at 533 Eclipse Ellis. What's the street?
Ellis Avenue.
Yeah, yeah. In Winnipeg's West End. Mm-hmm. And we're in the John Howard Society office. And Emily, you're doing comms with the society now.
Yeah, so I'm the communications coordinator at the John Howard Society. The John Howard Society is a group of nonprofits that spans across Canada that works to support individuals before, during, and after incarceration. So we provide a number of services to help people navigate the incredibly difficult legal system and carceral system. And we advocate for changes to assist people in rebuilding healthy lives after their experience with the criminal justice system.
And keen listeners will recognize Emily as a former voice at Press Progress, doing labor reporting with Rank and File, and someone who's been in Winnipeg for a long time. And John, people might know you through your music with the Weaker Thens and Propagandhi, but people might not know that your professional work is with the John Howard Society.
Yeah, that's true.
And your title and your role?
So my title is literacy instructor. That's right. So I work with the literacy department here. We're really lucky that we have Emily here now to help us out. And so I've been here for 2 years now, I think.
And you're a native Winnipegger.
I am. I've been here the whole time. 53 years.
53 years.
Yeah, yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
So for people who don't know, what is the John Howard Society? Just like simply put, you guys work as outreach and education with?
With incarcerated individuals, and we provide a number of different programs. We provide reintegration services, so, you know, very practical things. If people need, boots for a construction job that they have, they need some new clothes after they've just got out, hygiene kits, birth certificates. We have healing and harm reduction addictions programs. We have a bail navigator program. We have pardon record suspension programs. We have the Four Healing Roads Lodge, which is a kind of halfway house upstairs. And providing just a number of services to help individuals get through this incredibly difficult process.
So
literacy is one of the programs that we offer and that we're here to talk about today.
And I'm curious about the legacy of the society and its history a bit, but first I'll just anchor this conversation in why I'm in Winnipeg and what we're doing and what we did two days ago.
It was yesterday.
Oh my God. Yeah. Listeners, we came. I came to Winnipeg to put on the fourth Progressive Public Symposium, and we put that on at the University of Winnipeg with Dr. Kevin Walby, who is a colleague of John Sampson and Emily, through his work as well with carceral justice. So yesterday, one of our panels was Kevin with L. Jones and Bronwyn.
Bob Chuckland.
Thank you.
Yeah.
And they had a wonderful conversation, which L. ended with poetry, which was a really lovely way to end the day. She's a really dynamic speaker.
Yeah.
And we began the symposium with a labor panel that Emily and I co-hosted with Scott Price from CKUW and John Weir from Douglas Coldwell Leighton Foundation. But you also began with some poetry in that one. So we had a nice bookending of poetry, which was kind of not standard for this sort of thing, which was really special. But these notions of carceral justice are like fresh in mind, especially because of how Elle just like spat. Have you heard hers?
I have, yeah, it's tremendous. Yeah, she's... Yeah,
so, cool. So with the society, it's been around for a long time.
Yeah, it's true. So it's weird because, like, it's not weird, but each kind of John Howard Society branch is its kind of own entity. So here in Manitoba, we have one in Winnipeg, one in Brandon. In places like Saskatchewan, there are almost a dozen, I think, offices, and each one is sort of separate but connected to John Howard Canada, which does some great work. And I go in to teach at Remand, at the Remand Center here often, and so I know about John Howard because everyone always says, "Are you John Howard?" And I have to say no. In fact, yeah. So I make the same joke every time I speak to anyone.
Like any teacher would.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, no, it's getting pretty dependable. It's got pretty dependable laughs, so I'm pretty, I'm not going to give it up.
That's a teacher's hat.
No. Well, so but John Howard himself was a really unusual 17th century British prison reformer who I'm quite puzzled by why.
Because?
We would name ourselves after him.
Do we know why?
No.
Oh.
So, interestingly, the Elizabeth Fry Society, which is our sister society, is named after a Quaker, and I'm a Quaker, so I know a lot about Elizabeth Fry, who was a really interesting prison activist in the 1800s. But I'm a bit confused about John Howard. I'm not sure what his deal was. But I think we have basically nothing.
That's an unsatisfying answer. Yeah. I'll urge listeners to go on Wikipedia and see if they can do the detective work.
Yeah, there's a picture of him there in the corner. You can see. I have a picture there that I sometimes pull out in my classes to make sure no one gets us confused.
Okay. Okay.
The important thing is that the John Howard Society provides many important services.
It does, Emily. Thank you.
And literacy programming is one of them, and we wanted to explore, you know, how did you come to this position of literacy instructor from your, you know, career as a musician working with different bands, and now you find yourself utilizing those skills, those creative that creative journey that you've had, is now you found yourself here. So I was wondering if you could share a bit about
I started kind of volunteering in prison work back in 2012 when two Quakers I know were running an organization here called, through the Mennonites, called Open Circle. And it was an organization where they would pair people on the outside with insiders who didn't get any visitors. So I was assigned, kind of randomly assigned, an insider named Dennis, who was incarcerated and lived... he was a lifer, and he lived, 10 hours from his reserve. And so no one really came to visit him. So I would go out every Thursday night to Stony Mountain and play cards. And he would beat me at cards every week. And then we would meet again the next week. And that went on for several years. And then he got transferred. And then I had the opportunity... Sorry, this is a long answer.
Please.
I had the opportunity to start a prison book club for inmates... out at Stony Mountain, just coincidentally through someone I met, a writer I met was setting it up. And so I got to co-found a chapter of that out at Stony Minimum. And I did that for 5 years. We would go out every month and we would all read a book together and then discuss the book. And mostly we didn't like the books or we didn't read the books and we would just hang out and talk, which kind of like, which that was my favorite part. So I did that for 5 years. And then just around the beginning of the pandemic, someone I knew from there asked if I would consider teaching through the Walls to Bridges program at the University of Winnipeg, which Kevin Walby, who you mentioned, started or helped start. And so Walls to Bridges has chapters across Canada, and they send instructors into jails to teach, and insiders can get points towards a degree. So I think they asked me to do it because they knew I had taught creative writing a little bit, but I crucially had my clearance to Stony Mountain, which is sort of hard to get, and during the pandemic was especially hard to get. So I started teaching there a creative writing class every week, and I taught in Max and Medium and Minimum, all three levels, a couple times, and I really loved it. It was really hard, and the beginning of the pandemic was really quite bonkers because it was still remote, and they would have guys. I would be on a tiny screen encased in plexiglass, and these guys would be 6 feet apart on a table, masked, and we were trying to do creative writing together, and it was astonishingly hard, but also astonishingly beautiful. Like, they let me go in the last day, like, fully masked up and everything, of course, but, and we made a zine on the last day of all our writing together, and I got to meet them, and then, so that was kind of my modus for those classes. Where it was basically a class on how to make a zine. So we would collect writings and then make a zine together at the end, and I did that with like six classes out there, cohorts out there, I think, and that was really fun. And then I had kind of taught everyone who was enrolled there, and then a classic kind of Winnipeg story. I was at the dog park, and I met this guy I really liked, Joel, who was walking his dog, and we would walk our dogs every day. And his partner was volunteering for the John Howard Literacy Department, going into remand and helping with the literacy classes. And she mentioned that there was a job opening here. And I applied and I got it, so that's how I got here. And I've been here for almost 3 years now, I think. That was very long-winded, sorry.
Not at all. When you said it was satisfying, I'm interested to hear about that. And I'm also interested to hear maybe a little about what it means for the guys to have that as an outlet. So what have you observed for that? Mm-hmm. And then also for you, how has this been meaningful as you've sort of switched careers or shifted into this realm?
Yeah, it's been profound for me. I think the goal of our department here, I work with two other amazing folks, Anna and Chanel, and our kind of goal is to really empower people to be able to express themselves, right? So that's kind of, I think, the main and maybe only thing we can do aside from system navigation. So I spend a lot of my week helping people, for example, write resumes and do other kind of system navigation stuff, but empowering people to be actually able to speak up for themselves and for others, I think they all, many of them are much better at it than I am, but they don't have the kind of like access points that I do, right? The kind of the cultural cachet and the you know, system, the comfortability with the system, right? So so empowerment, I feel like they really like the zines and writing. Like, I think people sometimes I kind of have to trick them into writing a little bit, and then once they do, they kind of like it. So
That's amazing. Emily, do you remember at our symposium, were they saying it was yesterday? I don't even know if that's accurate. Who was tabling with a restorative justice table. Did you catch her name and her organization?
Yeah, the organization was Ona Shawiwin.
Yeah, they're amazing. Yeah. They do amazing work.
Yeah.
And so they were really happy to be there. What was her name?
I don't know the person's name who was tabling specifically, but I was glad to see them.
It was so nice to see them, and they were delighted to be there. And because of Kevin Walby's sort of outreach to ask people to come table at the symposium, we were able to have them there. But I was chatting with her, and I love how forward-focused there is with the sort of stuff with the John Howard Society, with Circles that was tabling. And I told her my dad was the guy who introduced restorative justice into Quebec as a sort of experimental thing.
Yeah, yeah.
And kind of helped to spearhead that for a number of years.
Mm-hmm.
And it's because he has, like, you know, Mennonite background and was a Mennonite pastor for years that this kind of work is very just, like, present in mind.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm, like, just really interested to be hearing how that works in different parts of the country and stuff. He became an Anglican priest, which is weird.
Yeah.
His boyfriend was Anglican, so that's the direction he took. But that's an interesting kind of career.
I know a lot of Mennonites who make the switch to Anglicans. Yeah,
really?
Yeah, here in Winnipeg, it's pretty common.
Why do you think that would be?
I think this is probably not relevant to our conversation, but I think there's something about the ritual and the intellectual vigor of some of the Anglican churches.
Okay.
So the ritual is a little higher, and my affinity is with the Mennonites.
Same.
I'm saying, like,
And we should be careful. Yeah. Emily, you're a defrocked Anglican deacon, so we don't want to talk about the controversy.
No, no. Well, I do think it's interesting. You mentioned, you know, being a Quaker earlier. I think that it is important to talk about the role of faith in this kind of work, because we are dealing with colonization. We're dealing with the effects of colonization. We're dealing with the complex histories of, like, residential schools and things that were run by, like, the Catholic Church and, like, you know, the imposition of you know, faith onto indigenous communities.
Doctrine of discovery. And,
all
yeah,
of these
absolutely,
things.
Yeah.
And so now we are here for a full disclosure for the listener. We're all, you know, white settler folks who are interested and engaged in, hopefully, work of, you know, reconciliation.
Right.
But that is challenging to figure out what that looks like specifically.
For sure.
We do have some ideas because they are 94 recommendations of the Truth and Reconciliation Calls to Action. But before we kind of get into that, I did want to talk about your background as a Quaker, because it is easy to see, you know, Christian faith movements as just, like, painted all with one brush, but there's quite a diverse way that people express their faith and navigate their faith in different cultural communities and different, you know, strains of it. And so Quakerism is one of them. And I'm wondering if you can highlight what about your Quaker background aids you in this kind of work.
And what is a Quaker? Because for a lot of people, we don't have much of a notion.
And
when I think of it, I always think, it's like Mennonite adjacent, but it's not really, but it kind of is in terms of its values, maybe.
Right.
So can you, like, unpack and demystify that a bit?
Absolutely. Shall we go back to this?
Please.
Civil War in England. And so Quakers are a Christian sect that has developed into a kind of, in Canada at least, into a kind of liberal Christian-based faith system. There are many, it's open to the point where there are many Quakers who do not consider themselves Christians, and a lot of non-theist Quakers. Mm. There's also Jewish and Muslim and Buddhist Quakers. Mm. So it's a big tent. And what drew me to it in the first place was actually prisons. So in 1981, Canadian Quakers, there's only about 1,200 of them. Mm. In 1981, they became what we think is the first national faith community to state their support for prison abolition. So, and it's a really interesting minute. It took years of work for them to build towards this decision to come out from reform, because Quakers have quite a history in prisons. Quakers have been reformers for a long time. They were also basically responsible for parts of the prison system as it is now. So the penitentiaries in Philadelphia that are the basis for our mass incarceration now were developed by some Quakers, for sure. So they have a lot to answer for. Canadian Quakers decided to turn their gaze from reform, which they were very active in, to abolition. And so I was like, that's the kind of community that I want to be a part of and have an outlet to actually work on abolitionist causes.
Did this happen, like, kind of in sync with your move into this career?
Yes. Okay. Yeah, it did kind of. Well, I think it's sort of responsible for my move into it. So when I talked about volunteering at, in my first experiences with my friend Dennis out at Stony, it was Quakers who ran that organization, right? So they were part of my monthly meeting or my weekly meeting, and they were the ones who said, you should come and do this. And so I did that. And there was kind of a spirit of abolition within the community that kind of, and it also just kind of gave me an opportunity to do things hands-on that I wouldn't have otherwise, I feel like. So that was kind of my in to working in prisons. And so now it's come kind of full circle a little bit. Now it's my job, but
I think it's so interesting because, like, Emily, you're in your 30s, I'm in my 40s, you're in your 50s.
Mm-hmm.
And probably each of those age cohorts are similar demographically in that people run away from faith. Like,
right.
this is a very kind of Canadian modern thing.
Yeah.
There's lots of faithy people, but there's lots of people who, like, run away from it. And in Montreal, it's easy because the church is kind of dead, so it's not threatening, and it's not that bad, right? So I love to go into Catholic churches and vibe. It reminds me of my grandma, right? but if I lived in, like, Calgary or, like, someplace with a big box store church,
yeah,
I'd be disgusted. Mm-hmm. So I guess my question is, what is it like to, or what was it about hitting your 50s, or, like, like, did you maybe have part of your background where you were already susceptible to be kind of returning to a faith?
Exactly.
And then maybe one more thing is, this is the Quakerism is faith, but it's also kind of practice in the work that you do.
Right.
So how much of it is about something more spiritual and how much about it is more practical and grounded in the world?
I think it's hard to say. I think part of the reason I wanted to reengage with the Christian community specifically, or be in a place where I could explore Christianity, was a feeling of responsibility for Christianity. I kind of began to think of it as, like, me saying that I wasn't a Christian was like me saying that I'm not a settler. To me, I'm like, I was shaped by Christianity. I know I can feel it in my very marrow. I was a Christian kid. I grew up that way. And I feel like I think Christianity is often appalling and has so much to answer for. So I think the way for me to do that is to work within it, I think, and recognize that I am part of that, right? And also, it's a great comfort. So I feel like it maybe earlier in my life, I was disdainful of comfort, and now I am not. I feel like any comfort I can get, I'll take. And, you know, like, I think I need it. Hmm. So people say that, you know, there's a weakness in people of faith, and I'm fine with that.
How about there's a vulnerability?
Sure, vulnerability, yeah.
So I think it's so interesting because, yeah, it's a very normal thing to be like, yep, I don't believe.
Mm-hmm.
But I find it really interesting to be able to have, yeah, like, something that grounds the lived life in something greater than ourselves.
It's also a community, right? Like, I feel like being in community is really hard and really important. So I'm in a Quaker meeting that I'm very much a part of. I'm a member of this community. And it's not easy. Like, there are people, there are disagreements, there are struggles, even though we're very small and not, you know, we don't own a building, we meet in a multi-purpose room at a housing co-op. There's still real struggles, like struggles with real community, and I feel like I want to be a part of those communities and a part of that struggle, like the struggle of
building something
together with people, right? So I think that I try and see it as kind of emanating, like that is my kind of like foundation, and trying to work, for example, in this work, let I try and take that same understanding of struggle into it.
This is an interesting evolution, though, because, like, okay, as a musician, and I played in bands a bit, too, if you're, like, part of a scene or you're touring or you're, like, within that nuclear family of a band, that's a community, but it's so, I don't know, the drive is totally different. This sounds like something much, not easier, but just, like, the pressure is maybe not there.
Right. It's more diffuse, right? Like, I feel like it's spread out. I'm also, like, it's hard to be in community, but I'm also held by that community, right? Like, that's part of what keeps me healthy and alive, frankly, is being a small cog in a larger community.
So
it's like with liberation theology and kind of a feminist tradition is the acknowledgement of, like, the ways that these faith communities do provide that community, provide that connection, family, support, all of these things. And so even those, like, very problematic elements of Christianity and everything, the liberation theology tradition exists out of South America, and acknowledging that the benefits and the comforts that that kind of community can provide, and some of the language and the wording, because there is a great amount of that language that talks about, you know, helping the poor and, like, the
preferential treatment for the poor. Yeah,
exactly. All of that. Blessed are the poor in spirit. Right. All of that. And being able to hang on to those values that resonate with people, and being able to shape it in a way that doesn't perpetuate the oppressions as to...
I think that's a really good point.
Which is complicated, but there's a tradition of doing that in different ways. And so I feel like what you're speaking of, and what I've observed here in Manitoba as well, is there is a community of, like, Mennonite settler Christians who are trying to take account for the role of Christianity and working with Indigenous communities, working in conversation and dialogue. Which is part of what is going on here.
Just talking about community, the work that we do with building independent media through Harbinger and through Unrigged is a really satisfying way of, like, building relationships with people, which is really special. But one of the things that I find really motivates and, like, makes me excited to go to the bed in the morning is that the horizon's always way over there. You're never going to reach it. So it's always the journey.
Yeah.
And that sort of journey of building community, as opposed to, like, having a destination where it's like, we have to get here, that's really satisfying. There's something zen about it.
Yeah.
So so finding ways to live in the world, I think, is the sort of higher level thing. And it's really cool to discover that... joining that Quaker community can help to anchor you and to anchor in the work.
And also, like, I feel like it's a great opportunity for organizing, too. Like, I feel like during the pandemic, I got together with mostly Mennonites, and we started this kind of book club, and we called it Treaty One Christians for Socialism. And we kind of, like, got together, and we would, like, do a book every month or an article, meet on Zoom. We did a few events. We wrote some letters, and it's kind of dormant now, but it was a really interesting idea because it made me think about, like, I'm not interested in organizing a church. I'm interested in organizing the people within those faith communities that are leftists, right? And there are a lot of them, and we can organize them as a force, I think, as a larger kind of web of a progressive movement. So I think it's underutilized.
For listeners, one of the reasons that we did the symposium this weekend was to be an off-fringe event for the NDP leadership convention, and that was a deliberate choice to do it, like, while this was happening. But that means that I was at the convention center, the RBC convention center, witnessing some of this politicking, mm-hmm. and I've been really not cynical, but really skeptical about the whole process. I haven't felt a lot of excitement, probably because we're in a uniquely existential moment in Canada and in the world. But it was really interesting hanging out with leftists. So